You're listening to the Weekly Sermon Podcast from Trinity Church Denver. To find out more about Trinity, visit our website at trinitychurchdenver.org. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast in your favorite podcast player to get the latest episodes as soon as they're available. And now, please enjoy the sermon.
I attended college in Chicago. In Chicago is a chain restaurant that only exists in Chicago, and it's called Portillo's. Portillo's is a magical place. Portillo's has hot dogs that are unlike hot dogs that you can make in your home. At Portillo's is this sandwich called the beef and cheddar croissant, which is a croissant with beef and cheddar soaked in the juices of said beef. It is not gross, and don't say those things. It is marvelous. It's magical. They have cheeseburgers that are amazing. They have salads that are unhealthy. They have everything imaginable that you could desire sitting here thinking, what would I have for lunch today? Beef and cheddar croissant. And I thought that almost every day of college. And I followed that through almost every day of college. And so Portillo's over my time in Chicago and during grad school, actually I would say Portillo's was one of the top five, I'm not going to say which number it was, one of the top five reasons to go to Chicago for grad school, and the beef and cheddar croissant would have been on the list as well, so it kind of fell that way. It was a magical place for me that I rejoiced to eat at any time I had the opportunity to eat at, and I took advantage of that often, using every spare dollar of my budget as a poor college student to spend it, not on valuable things, but on Portillo's. And so Portillo's, as you can imagine, is a place that is near and dear to my heart. And this fall, my family and I, driving to see family in Michigan, got to drive through the bottom portion of Chicago. While driving through the bottom portion of Chicago, we were within striking distance, say 30 minutes or so, of a Portillo's. And so what did we do? We took a detour to Portillo's, because heaven forbid we're within 3 hours of Portillo's and we don't go there. And so we took a drive into Chicago to get to the southernmost Portillo's. We went to said Portillo's, and as we pulled up, an interesting thing took place. There were three kinds of people in my car at the time. There was me, who had expansive understanding of what Portillo's was, what it represented to me, what it represented to the world in terms of hope and joy and deliciousness. There was also my wife, for whom Portillo's is, I'll just say it foolishly, a vile thing. A thing to be cast out. Thing to be avoided at most costs, because the fact that you can get a salad there that probably has more fat and cholesterol and sugar in it than a donut from Krispy Kreme. And so she doesn't like it. She has almost a reviling sense of, what are we doing here? This is taking years off my husband's life. And then there were my children who have they have zero experience with Portillo's. They don't know what it is. They don't know why they should like it. They're kind of nonchalant. They're a little bit annoyed that we're getting out of the car to go into a restaurant. They don't understand their dad's excitement, but he's weird. He gets excited over all kinds of weird things. And they're starting to sense that this is something mom doesn't like, and therefore we should like it. And so there's that kind of sense in the car. But what was interesting to me as we went into Portillo's and enjoyed a glorious meal was that all three of us were looking at the exact same scene. Portillo's are designed to look like a warehouse out of the Prohibition era. We're all looking at the exact same scene from the outside. We all see the sign that says Portillo's. We all see the signs that say famous hot dogs. We all see everything exactly the same. I've even described for them what they should be looking for as we arrive at this Portillo's. And we had three completely different reactions. Me jumping with glee, almost sprinting inside of the building, trying to figure out, what am I going to order for dinner? And then Jenny slowly kind of like, okay, let's just control ourselves a little bit, maybe eat half a sandwich, very slowly, a little bit kind of resistant to what was about to happen, and my kids shrugging their shoulders, just slightly annoyed that we have to get out of the car. It's late at night. Why in the world did we drive an extra hour out of the way total rather than just going straight to our destination? In other words, there was one scene, one thing that everyone was looking at, and three different, completely different, radically different responses to what was happening. Excitement beyond all measure, resistance, like, oh no, like I don't know about this, and then kind of an annoyed shrug of the shoulders. We've been working our way through the last two chapters of Luke's gospel, examining kind of the words of Jesus and what's happening around him as the scenes leading to the cross have unfolded. And today, as Luke continues to kind of unfold what's taken place, we're going to notice that everyone around the cross is looking at the same thing. They all see a man who just a few days before had been hailed as king, as this was the promised one. This was the son of David. This was the one who comes bearing the name of God. In other words, bearing the very authority of God himself into Jerusalem with thousands singing his praises. And now he hangs on a cross, naked, beaten, bloodied, difficult to look at. Everyone's seeing the same thing. And the responses are stark. The responses couldn't be any more different. And so I want us to look at this text, but first I want to set it up by kind of rehearsing a little bit of what we celebrated this morning. This morning we had kids with palm branches, we had some of the adults with palm branches, we had kids hitting you in the face with palm branches, we had some of the adults hitting you face with palm branches, we had singing, we had shouting. I want you to take what we experienced at the beginning of our service this morning and multiply it by about 100,000. Most estimates is that somewhere between 50 and 150,000 people, in addition to those who already lived in Jerusalem, would journey from all over the Roman Empire, from all over the world, to come to Jerusalem to celebrate and to commemorate the Passover. This is a particularly heightened political time. The Passover carried with it overtones of God's liberation of Israel from Egypt. It celebrated their liberation from Egypt, and it carried with it the hope, the promise that God might do that again in liberating Israel, liberating Jerusalem from the rule of Rome. And so Jews from everywhere would travel to Jerusalem every year to celebrate the Passover meal. And the influx of people would have been so many that there wasn't enough places to stay in Jerusalem. And so many people would stay in neighboring towns, and some would even camp in tents, like some of you do for fun in the summer, outside. Notice I said some of you, not some of us. And so around Jerusalem in celebrating Passover. Now, one of the things you should imagine is not this solemn gathering. Now, you should imagine something like just a giant party, like lots and lots and lots and lots of people, people as far as you can see. And so when Jesus begins to march into Jerusalem riding on a donkey, oftentimes much is made of the mention of in humility or humble, the mention in Zechariah, but that's somehow is attached to the donkey, and somehow a man riding a donkey is less than kingly. That's couldn't be further from the truth. In the first century and before and even after, Roman generals, those who had conquered, who ruled, who were emperors, everywhere in the ancient Near East, if you had conquered your enemies, a sign that you were at peace, that you were at rest, that you weren't threatened by anyone, is you rode a donkey. That as you rode into the city where you reigned, you rode on a donkey, not on a war horse, because you didn't come at war. You come as one who'd already conquered. Now riding at peace as the conquering king. So don't imagine 30 or 40 kids surrounding the road hitting Jesus in the face with palm branches. No, imagine 50,000 people with palm branches taking their cloaks off and laying them on the ground, shouting and singing as loud as they could all the way into Jerusalem. Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Shouting and singing outside of the city of Jerusalem, filling the streets of Jerusalem with shouts that here is the one who comes in the name of the Lord. Here is the Son of David, the one we've been waiting for, the one we've anticipated, the one we've longed for. The one that was promised that when he came, he would bring about a new Passover, a new liberation. That all of our enemies would be conquered and he would reign forever and ever and ever. That's the scene. This isn't a small group. This isn't a church gathering in a corner. This is the people of Israel gathered around Jesus by the tens of thousands, shouting and singing and filling the city. No longer just with the rumor. The rumor had reverberated for years. But no, with the song, the claim, the proclamation, the king is here. The day has come. He reigns. But now in chapter 23, the scene has completely shifted. And now we don't see a man riding on a donkey, a man hailed as king, as the one bearing the very authority of God. No, instead we see a man who's been beaten within an inch of his life. He would have been unrecognizable to those who know him. Skin torn everywhere, bruised and swollen and beaten. Barely able to stand and carry a crossbeam of wood. His back in tatters, his legs in tatters. Now, hanging on a cross, naked. Nails driven through his wrists and his ankles. Hanging on a cross. No more shouts, Hosanna. No more singing, here is the one who comes in the name of the Lord. No more declarations that here is the Son of David, the promised one. A whole different scene unfolds. But Luke's contention, and what I'll hold out to you this morning, is what was happening on Palm Sunday could have been happening on Good Friday. Here was the king. Here still is the Son of David. Here still is the one who comes in the name of the Lord, bearing the very authority of God. Oh, now he's not riding on a donkey. Now he hangs on a cross. And then what we see in these verses, what we see that I want to just draw our attention to this morning, is that there are vastly different responses to the same scene. There are groups here who respond in opposite ways to what they behold of this man on a cross. And I want to hold out to you that how you respond to this scene is the most important thing about you. How you respond to this vision of Jesus, dare I say, is everything. So how do people respond? Prior to our text, we have leaders surrounding the cross. We even have a thief dying next to Jesus, mocking Jesus. And there are many in our day who mock Jesus. They see the kind of natural irony in what's unfolding. Here's the king. Here's the conquering king. The king who would conquer Rome. The most powerful empire in history. Here's the one who would overthrow Rome. Here's the one that would conquer all of God's enemies. Here's the promised king, the one hailed and sung about and declared in glory and power and honor for centuries. Here's the one that we sang about and we read prophecies about. Here's the one we anticipated coming forever and ever and ever. Dying on a cross, spit upon, mocked. Save yourself. How is he going to conquer Rome if he's just hanging on a cross? He can't even save himself. Surrounding the cross were men and were women, were leaders, were religious leaders, were political leaders, were people who saw what everyone else saw. They saw Palm Sunday and they saw Good Friday, and the response is to spit, to mock, to belittle. To say, you fools, you believed he would save you? And this is a response. This is one of the responses to the cross. And some of you in this room, that may be your kind of most visceral response to hearing the story of Jesus. What kind of fools believe this nonsense? That here's the Lord, the King, the one who conquers evil and sin and death? Do you guys not see how silly this is, how mockable this is? So that's one response. It's a response that may actually be in this room. It's a response that absolutely exists in the world around us. If we're just honest, can you at least sympathize with that view? I think you need to be able to. Like, this is what we confess and believe. That the Lord, the one who bears God's authority in the world, the one who is King, the one who's God incarnate, the one who defeats evil and sin and death, hangs on a cross, dying one of the most horrific deaths imaginable, certainly one of the most shameful deaths imaginable. And we point and say, Lord, this would be folly if it wasn't true. Second response. The thief that also mocked treated him as a peer. You're like us. You're dying on a cross. Like, at least save yourself. And I think this is another response to seeing Jesus on the cross. There's not the raids. There's not this, I hate God, I hate this God on the cross. There's kind of a shrug of the shoulders and say, well, why is so much made of this Jesus? He's just another human who suffered and died. Maybe he's a model for us. Maybe he's just someone who died a particularly special death that people took note of for centuries. It's a story maybe that we can learn things from. But the general posture is they behold what everyone else around the cross is beholding is simply to shrug their shoulders and go like, okay, I don't really know what to make of this. I don't understand why people have worshipped this man. He's just another human who died a sad death like so many others died at the hands of the Romans. He's just another one of us. And this is a response in our day, and dare I say, probably in this room. You behold this Jesus on the cross, this man beaten and bruised and hung on a cross and killed like thousands upon thousands of others who died during the reign of Rome. You see it just as another expression of kind of the evil of the Roman Empire. You see it just as one more expression of kind of the ubiquitous of human suffering. And kind of if you shrug your shoulders, you're not quite sure why people cry and get all bent out of shape and get all excited about the person of Jesus and want to follow Jesus and love Jesus and make so much of this thing called Good Friday and Easter. You just kind of shrug your shoulders. You don't hate him. You don't hate Christians. You don't hate Christianity. You're just kind of nonchalant about the whole thing. Neither here nor there. If that helps those people, great. But that's not me. Which, as the rest of the New Testament unfolds, becomes increasingly not an option. And if you look at the rest of Luke's gospel, one of the things that you see is that isn't the way that almost anyone responded to Jesus. Almost no one who encountered Jesus as he was, almost no one who encountered the early church as it proclaimed the message of Jesus, almost no one who encountered it shrugged their shoulders and said, I don't know, it's not really relevant to me. Oh, hate him or worship him. But don't shrug your shoulders. And so this morning, if you find yourself in that place of shrugging, my prayer for you is that you would encounter Jesus as he actually is. And I pray that knowing full well that not everyone loved Jesus. Most people didn't when they first met him. We sometimes have this idea of Jesus being this like nice guy that everybody wanted to hang out with. I love Jesus, man. He's so fun. He's like the guy at the party. You know, most people met him and hated him. Not hated him like, man, he's kind of the guy that makes everything serious at the party. But like language is used in the New Testament of people gnashing their teeth at Jesus. When's the last time somebody gnashed their teeth at you? Like, there's people who don't like you. I don't know if you know that. There are definitely people who don't like you. But I don't think they like gnash their teeth at you. Unless they've got some problems. People would gnash their teeth at Jesus. So my prayer for you this morning is that you would worship him or gnash your teeth at him. But don't shrug your shoulders. And I'm going to look at this, the crowd. And if I'm honest, like the thing I've been most concerned about for us as a people is that we'd be like the crowd. It says the crowd had come along. They'd come to see this thing, to see this spectacle. In other words, they were curious. They wanted to follow Jesus and kind of see how this thing unfolded. They were curious. They wanted to see what was happening. They wanted to see the blood and the gore. They wanted to see the things surrounding Jesus. But in the end, they go home beating their chests. And this is a sign of mourning. So when you see people beating their chest, you shouldn't think like a gorilla who beats his chest. You shouldn't think like a sign of strength, or even a sign of rage. You should see it as a sign of mourning, of disappointment. They see Jesus hanging on the cross to see the things of what they actually see who Jesus is. It's probably been the same crowd shouting about the coming of King David. They actually see what that reign is like. They see who Jesus actually is hanging on the cross, and they leave overwhelmed with grief. Not grief because they saw a good man die. Grief because they saw he isn't what they wanted him to be. And here's the reality. Many of us have grown up or up around Christianity, curious about Jesus, maybe even singing songs about Jesus, maybe even loving Jesus. And then something happens in your life. Tragedy strikes. Maybe it's just really practical, like your health fails. Hard times happen in your job. Maybe for you it's more intellectual. You begin to see things in the Bible that are disturbing, because there's a lot of disturbing things in this book. And you've followed Jesus thinking, here's the king, rah, rah, rah. I'm curious about him. He's a spectacle. I love the things around Jesus. We like Jesus. We like church. We like how it all makes us feel. And then you actually encounter the fact that Jesus is not the king you want him to be. He's the king who he is. He's the king with absolute authority in himself. And he's not taking votes. He's not asking for suggestions. He rules and he reigns over the earth and over our lives with an absolute authority. He often does so and leads us in paths that we don't always understand. He calls us to a kind of obedience that we don't like. He speaks in ways that we're not comfortable with. He commands our friends to do things that they don't like. He becomes embarrassing or offensive. We see a king who goes to a cross and dies and doesn't just lead us up and to the right constantly. but a Jesus who calls, if you're going to come after me, take up your cross. That's how he defines discipleship. We encounter this Jesus and we walk away mourning. He's not who we thought he was. He's not the king that we thought would bring us just endless joy and happiness and fulfillment. We go to the cross, we see a spectacle, we don't know what to do with it, and so we walk away beating our chests. And I'm afraid for many of us, that's the kind of Christianity we've grown up in and around. We love the conquering king. We love the songs. We love the palm branches. We love the spectacle of Jesus. But we don't know what to do when we see him on a cross, dying, bloodied, beaten, mocked, spit, telling us that if we're going to follow him, we must do the same. So some, when they actually encounter Jesus, when they see this scene, when they see Jesus as he is, they walk away, they go home. This isn't what I signed up for. Then there's two responses, and this is where we'll end, that Luke commends to us. And you can kind of see it woven throughout these last two paragraphs, this theme of seeing or watching. First, you'll see that the centurion, verse 47, now the centurion saw. So here's the centurion. Centurion's a Roman general in authority over troops. He would have been overseeing everything that's happening there as these criminals are crucified. He's overseeing the soldiers. There would have been extra soldiers there when it's Passover weekend, so there's a giant crowd too. Romans crucifying Jews never went well, particularly in Jerusalem, and so there would have been extra soldiers there just to make sure that a riot didn't break out, especially a riot around this one that everyone had hailed as king of the Jews. And so there would have been a centurion. So this is a higher up. This is a general. This is someone with an enormous amount of power. And it says that he's watching. He's seen everything unfold. And so Luke describes the centurion of seeing. Next, he describes the acquaintances. These would have been not Jesus' immediate disciples, but kind of the second ring out. People who knew who Jesus was. Maybe he stayed at their house. They were familiar with him. They could have waved and said hi as they saw each other on the street. But they weren't necessarily the ones that had followed him everywhere and go there. Standing there, it says, and they're watching what's happening. They're watching carefully what happens. And then it's interesting, Luke emphasizes this, that there are women who had followed him all the way from Galilee. I love this. The disciples are gone. And a group of women who have followed him from the beginning, standing by, watching everything unfold. Not beating their chests, and not overwhelmed and discouraged, just waiting, just watching. Faithfulness of these watching women. And then everyone responds to this scene as they see it in different ways, but this group, the centurion, what an odd group. Gentile centurion, women from Galilee, the backcountry, we'll call it Arkansas. If you're from Arkansas, laugh at yourself. The acquaintances of Jesus, they respond in a way that I would commend to you this morning. First, the centurion sees what takes place, Luke says, and he worships God. See how different that is? He sees something unfolding in front of him, but he sees in it something that no one else has seen. The temptation to just shrug our shoulders, I don't know what to do with this. The rejection, the beating of the breast, I don't want anything to do with this, Jesus. This isn't what I signed up for. The mocking of Jesus, like, save yourself. No, but this centurion sees the same thing they're seeing. He sees this cross, and he falls on his face, and he worships God. Other gospel writers say that he confesses, Mark actually, that he puts on the lips of this centurion, surely this man was the Son of the living God. It's ironic in Mark's gospel. Mark's constantly setting up this contrast that the Jews are constantly missing. Here's their Messiah. Here's the one that was promised to them in their scriptures, and they're missing it. They're blind to it. And yet here's a Gentile who they would call a blind man. It's actually a theme always in Mark's gospel that the blind men are the ones who see, and the ones who are able to see are blind. Here's a Gentile who shouldn't be able to see anything of Yahweh in front of him, and he's the one, the only one, who rightly confesses, here is the Son of God. Luke says he worships the God of Israel. When you see Jesus on the cross, do you mock? Do you shrug your shoulders? Do you beat your breast and say, this isn't what I signed up for? Or do you fall on your face and say, what must God be like? That he rescues and he redeems. That he bears the penalty for my sin. That the one who is king, the one who reigns, the one who comes bearing the very name of God, dies. The centurion worships. The women, they watch. They watch closely. And the text says to us right at the beginning, right at the end of verse 56, they watched where he was laid. They watched the whole thing unfold. And they saw the tomb. They see where it's laid. And they go home and they prepare. And so you have the centurion who sees Jesus and worships. You have these women who watch. They see the death of Jesus. And they begin to prepare. To wait. To watch. To prepare to honor Jesus. When you see Jesus, what do you see? How do you respond? It is the most central, the most vital, the most essential thing about you. How do you respond to this man hanging on the cross? Do you shrug your shoulders? I don't know. It's an interesting religion, interesting thought. Do you mock? Do you see in Christianity, do you see in this story of Jesus, something just absolutely foolish and detestable? When you encounter Jesus on the cross, do you beat your breast and say, this isn't what I signed up for? Let's talk about Jesus on the donkey. Let's talk about how Jesus healed the sick. Let's talk about all the up and to the right things, the celebratory things, the happy things, the good things. But when I encounter the pain of my sin, when I encounter the cost of Jesus' victory, when I encounter the reality of God's wrath, when I encounter the absolute authority of Jesus over all of the earth, dying on the cross for me. I just walk away. I don't want anything to do with that. Or do you fall down and worship and watch and prepare? This week on Friday, we will gather in this room to stare at the cross. It will be not an invitation to just be horrified by the scene. It will be an invitation to worship, to encounter and see your God as he is, the one who atones for your sins, who adopts you as a father, who reigns forever and ever. It will be an invitation to watch, to worship, and to prepare for Easter, to prepare to celebrate the one who has conquered sin and death, who reigns forever over us and for us. The question this morning is, what do you see? Let's pray.